Experts urge caution on delaying second vaccine shot. So says the lead headline in the Irish Times over a report that senior medics and experts say that a significant benefit to the vaccination programme would be needed to justify extending the gap between doses of COVID-19 vaccines. The Irish Independent leads with the news that three cases of the new Indian strain of coronavirus were detected in Ireland yesterday. The variant, which has already been found in Britain, has seen India added to the UK's red list of countries for mandatory hotel quarantine. It is still unclear if a similar decision would be made here, the paper says. In the Irish Examiner's main front page story, it is reported that the European Commission has ruled that Ireland cannot be trusted to police its fishing quotas under the Common Fisheries Policy. Michael Clifford writes that the Commission has withdrawn a special derogation to the state to weigh fish at factories because the authorities cannot guarantee that fraud will be detected. The Commission has ruled that fish must be weighed at the landing point. The Independent's front page picture is of Leeds United players warming up for their match against Liverpool last night, wearing T-shirts protesting against plans for a European Super League involving six of England's top teams. The Times reports UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's declaration, to be broadcast tonight on BBC Northern Ireland, that there will be no referendum on the reunification of Ireland for a very, very long time to come. The Irish Sun, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Daily Star lead with the appearance in court yesterday of Gavin Murphy, charged with the murder of his partner Jenny Poole at her home in Finglas, Dublin on Saturday. The Sun front page also carries a photograph of beer glasses laid out on the pavement outside Leinster House to form the figure 400. They were put there by the Licensed Vintners Association to mark 400 days of pub closures. Beer in Sun by May 24, says the headline, hopefully, though this is a demand from the vintners, not a promise. But the paper does report the Minister for Higher Education, Simon Harris, as hinting that more restrictions could be lifted next month. And the same hint from the same minister gives the Irish Daily Mail its lead story. He hinted that outdoor dining could resume as early as next month, the paper says. As for the pubs, in the Times Health and Family section, Paddy Murray writes about his local sports club. The bar there is closed, but he reckons that, like every other bar in the country, it's not going to be as simple as opening up when the government says we can. Because many people who would love to have a nice creamy pint will be reluctant to have it in a packed bar. And, in my case at least, twice as reluctant to have it in an empty bar.
Let's talk to our political correspondent Paul Cunningham now, ahead of today's cabinet meeting. And Paul, they're all meeting in person, aren't they, for the first time this year rather than via Zoom?
Yeah, I think it's an indication once again that there's improvement in the position of public health, and that the Cabinet is reflecting that by gathering at Dublin Castle today for its meeting, which usually lasts around 3 hours or so. So an important meeting.
Will there be an update on the vaccination programme?
We would expect both from the Taoiseach and from the Minister of Health to be a discussion on the question of the vaccination programme, where it's at. But there are no big decisions slated on this issue. As Fergal has just been outlining, some of the questions about delaying the second dose, that really is awaiting on information from the National Immunisation Committee, or it's waiting from a report from the Deputy Chief Medical Officer. So nothing big like that is happening, just an update on where we currently stand.
OK, so other matters are on the agenda today, including ticket touting. Now, this is something that's been around for a long time. In my ignorance, I thought this issue had been sorted out, but it hasn't. So what's happening today?
Yeah, I mean, this has been an issue which has been discussed for years. I mean, the person who's probably most closely associated to it was the former Fine Gael TD, Noel Rock. He lost a seat in the last election, but the Dublin North West TD had been campaigning on it, along with, it has to be said, Sinn Féin's Maurice Quinn Livin of Limerick City. The two of them really were going on this issue. Finally, it's going to come to Cabinet, being brought by the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar. And basically what they're trying to do in the what's known as the Sale of Tickets, Cultural, Entertainment, Recreation and Sporting Events Bill is to try and ban people being scalped, in which bills or in which tickets have been put on sale for multiples of the face value price within minutes of tickets going online. And they're going to do us two ways. One is that either an event or a venue will be designated, after which the resale of tickets beyond their face value is prohibited. And then the big stick is that anyone who's found to have been guilty of trying to scalp people will face either a fine of up to €100,000 or up to 2 years imprisonment. So that sounds like a fairly hefty fine for anyone breaking the law.
Of course, not many people buying tickets for anything at the moment, but I suppose they're conscious that the big European championship finals are starting in June.
Indeed, the old Euros is something we've been talking about for quite some time, although there's a big question mark over that. Also, given the shenanigans which have been taking place with UEFA and the possibility of a new Super League being formed, but the government wanted to get this over the line and is keen to do just that.
A couple of other things on the agenda as well. A Leaving Cert accreditation bill. What's that, Paul?
We haven't got too much details on that. Sometimes when it comes to these cabinet meetings, you get a sense of bills that are coming up for discussion, sometimes coming up for a decision. Equally, we know that the Minister for Finance is going to be giving an update on the OECD and Ireland's corporate tax rate. But once again, just exactly what is going to be decided on that, we don't know just yet.
Okay, tonight on BBC One, Mark Devenport, who's the former political editor with BBC Northern Ireland, he's made a special spotlight film for tonight, marking the centenary of Northern Ireland. And he has spoken to a range of people, including the Taoiseach and the British Prime Minister. Now, the British Prime Minister has said some pretty strong words to do with a border poll. What has he said?
Well, an interesting programme coming up tonight. But basically, the British Prime Minister has said that there will be no referendum on the reunification of Ireland for a very, very long time to come. And I think that's probably not much of a surprise, given he's saying something similar when it comes to Scotland. He describes himself as a keen unionist, and this is something, a road that he does not want to go down, feels that it's wrong. And equally, there's an interview with the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, who, in his view, describes an early border poll as something which would be explosive and divisive. I think, you know, maybe there isn't too much of a surprise in what both men had to say, but the one which sort of really caught my eye, Audrey, was this issue of the Northern Ireland Protocol. As people will know, the Democratic Unionist Party is keen to have it scrapped, and, you know, the British Prime Minister is asked about this, and he too describes what he calls ludicrous barriers to internal trade that have to be changed. But I think the key thing that comes out of it is that he says his government is going to try and sandpaper rather than scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol. So that's a clear indication that he's going to try and do what the EU has been calling for, is to try and negotiate a settlement to these difficulties which have put Northern Ireland, as many people in Northern Ireland feel, at a sort of worse place than the rest of Great Britain. And I think that he's prepared to work the internal mechanisms rather than simply try and scrap it all together is a key signal coming from number 10.
Okay, Paul, thank you very much. Paul Cunningham, our political correspondent.
Last week was one of uncertainty around vaccination and supply. This week is one for decisions. Decisions on whether to widen the interval between delivery of the first and second doses of Pfizer and Moderna, and on the rollout of the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. At last night's NPHET briefing, the acting chief medical officer, Dr. Ronan Lynn, was optimistic about the latest figures and trends and the overall situation here.
We're seeing an ongoing improving situation in relation to incidence, numbers of people in hospital. The number of people in critical care has stabilised at about 50, and we're seeing about 2 new admissions on average to intensive care each day. And then in relation to deaths confirmed per day, although we've reported no deaths today, we've reported approximately 8 deaths on average over recent days. Although many of those, just to caution, will be from January, February and March of this year. So as I said, ongoing improvement in the overall situation with a 5-day moving average now of 364 cases per day, which is the lowest it's been for some months.
That's Dr. Ronan Lynn. Our health correspondent Fergal Bowers is with me now. All positive signs there from the acting chief medical officer, Fergal. And moving on to vaccinations, he is the man who will ultimately decide, after he's consulted, if we should stick to the plan now or should vary the interval between the delivery of the doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Are there early indications on his thinking?
Well, I think there may not be a need to widen the gap between the first and second doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines. And currently, the authorised licence gap is 3 weeks for Pfizer and 4 weeks for Moderna. But the experts, they have been looking at, you know, the possibility of extending that maybe up to 8 weeks or up to 12 weeks. It would allow more people get a significant benefit from a first dose. But I suppose the principal thing is that you don't need to do that if you have enough vaccines. It's only if there's a vaccine shortage would you really want to go down that road. So Dr. Ronan Glynn, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, he said there were pros and cons to it. If you did extend the gap, you'd prolong the vaccination programme. Do you want to do that? It's already long enough, really. And no decision has to be made now at this moment. So no recommendation has yet been made to government. And Dr. Glynn wants to hear from the European Medicines Agency later this week on its position on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which was paused last week to allow for an investigation, a review of the reports of a small number of rare blood clots. So no decision yet to extend the interval. It may not happen. It's important to say here that none of this applies to the AstraZeneca vaccine, which already has a 12-week interval between the first and second dose, and indeed in some cases 16 weeks. So people who will get or get the AstraZeneca vaccine, they do have to wait 3 months, maybe up to 4 months for their second dose.
Fergal, I want to move on to these concerns raised at the NPHET briefing last night as well about this B1617 variant first identified in India. Let's hear first from Dr. Killian de Gascon about this and the other variants first identified in Brazil and South Africa.
It is a concern in the context that the number, I suppose, continues to increase. But obviously, we're doing a lot of testing, whether that's through contact tracing of the existing cases and then testing as people as they arrive from overseas travel. There is a component, I think it's probably in the region of 20 to 25% that doesn't have an obvious link to travel. So there's obviously public health investigations ongoing in relation to that. So in the context of the number of cases we have, it's still very small, but it does continue to increase. So I think it's something that we need to remain sort of vigilant and try to contain and control as much as we can.
Dr. Killian de Gascon there. Fergal, 3 cases here so far, over 100 in the UK of this Indian variant, and the UK moving now to put India on its red list of countries. What do we know about this variant?
Well, I suppose the most important thing is the Indian variant is not yet a variant of concern. The 3 variants of concern are the UK variant, the Brazilian and the South African. Now, NPHET says that the number of cases of the Indian variant, it's 3, and they've identified those cases in recent days. They don't have data to determine if the Indian variant is more transmissible or not. And NPHET's expecting guidance on this, on the transmission issue, from the European Centre for Disease Control this week.
This question of the red list of countries, as I say, the UK moving to place India on that list, was there any question of that being raised with Dr. de Gascon or with Ronan Glynn?
I suppose not at this point. It's clear that they're looking for more information in relation to this variant. And if it becomes, if it's officially designated as a variant of concern, then, you know, you could see those kind of measures.
Okay. Now, on the delivery of vaccination, the HSE now has, I think, 19 of its proposed 37 centres open and operating for business, around 1,500 vaccinators. So do you anticipate that we're now going to see this week, Fergal, a significant stepping up of the vaccination programme?
Well, you'll recall that overall the previous target was to do 250,000 vaccinations each week in April. Now, this coming week, the expectation is that 170,000 vaccinations will be done. So for each week that the targets or the aims aren't met, it pushes on the numbers that need to be vaccinated in the weeks which follow. So It does add to pressure. That portal for registering people aged 65 to 69 age group, well, that opened last Thursday. And at this point, you know, those aged 65 to 69, they can still register. By yesterday evening, 135,000 people had done so online or by phone. But there's 224,000 people in that age group, according to the CSO data. So you'd have to say quite a number of people haven't registered. Now, some may have been captured in other groups, high-risk medical groups or some nursing home cases, perhaps. But it's quite a large number. Everyone in that 65 to 69 age group will get the AstraZeneca vaccine. That's the vaccine that has been allocated for that particular group. Perhaps that's causing some concern among some people in relation to that, that they'd like to have a choice. But those are the numbers as of now.
OK, and they're moving on to the group now between 60 and 65.
Yes, the HSC said it hopes to open registration for people aged 60 to 65 years later this week. And again, on that earlier point I made about AstraZeneca, you know, for people who get their first doses, you know, those aged 65 to 69 or even 60 to 69, it'll be the end of July, you know, before many of them get their second dose.
And I know there's a further briefing note to the Health Committee today in relation to the categories and age groups and so on and delivery of vaccinations. But just on those who received a vaccination, Fergal, maybe out of turn, will they get the second vaccination now within the time period that they should receive it?
Yes, I suppose the simple answer is yes. In a submission to the Oireachtas Health Committee today, the HSC said, you know, once the first dose had been given, it's ethically obliged to complete the vaccination of second doses. And it has said it very much regrets the incidents in which a number of people received the first dose out of the agreed sequence of the government allocation priority groups. But it says people have to get the second dose. That's in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions, and in the absence of any contraindications, they will get their second dose.
All right. Fergal Barra is our health correspondent. Thank you very much. To Russia now, where the jailed opposition leader and prominent Putin critic Alexei Navalny has been moved to a prison hospital as supporters voice growing concern about his health. He's 3 weeks into a hunger strike. While Russian authorities insist his medical condition is satisfactory, private doctors have warned he could die at any moment. The US and EU have warned that they'll hold Moscow accountable for his health. I'm joined by the BBC Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford. Sarah, Mr. Navalny received a visit from his lawyer yesterday. What did he report later about Navalny's state of health now and indeed state of mind?
Well, he was only allowed in to see Alexei Navalny for a few minutes. This, of course, after, as you mentioned, Mr. Navalny had been moved not just to a prison hospital, but to a different prison altogether. So he was moved some 80 kilometres or so further away from Moscow. His lawyer managed to get to speak to him briefly, as I say. And when I spoke to the lawyer after he came out, he said that Alexei Navalny had got really thin. He was very weak. He said, it's clear he's in a bad way. Now, the reason that Alexei Navalny is on hunger strike is that he had some health problems, some symptoms he was reporting a few weeks back, a very severe acute pain in his back, numbness in his legs and in his arms. And he started demanding that an independent doctor, a doctor he could trust from outside the prison system, be allowed to come in and examine him, which actually is allowed under Russian law. He was denied that, and so he went on hunger strike. And now those symptoms continue. But on top of that, of course, 3 weeks of hunger strike are really beginning to take their toll. So he has been taken to the prison hospital, this different prison, and he was given an injection of glucose. But certainly his supporters have been saying that his health, and the phrase they're using, his life, is hanging by a thread.
Are there any indications at all that Vladimir Putin and the authorities might accede to his request for independent doctors?
Well, quite the opposite, actually. And in fact, Alexei Navalny again told his lawyer that he'd been told by the prison authorities that it was never going to happen, that an outside doctor would not be admitted to see him. which is quite extraordinary, really, because it's not that much of a huge demand. As I say, it is something that's permitted by the rules and regulations of the prison system here. But clearly, this is a battle of wills to some extent. Alexei Navalny trying, first of all, to get medical help, but also, of course, trying to keep himself in the political spotlight here, and the Kremlin trying to do its best to pretend that nothing's happening. The spokesperson for Vladimir Putin is asked every single morning by his journalists, what's happening, what's going on, what's the Kremlin going to do? And they sort of say, kind of, what are you talking about? You know, this is just any other prisoner. He's going to be treated like any other prisoner. We're not following, we're not even monitoring the situation. Now, that, of course, isn't true. They, of course, are monitoring it, but they're certainly trying to play down all these concerns that Navalny's supporters are raising all the time.
It does make you wonder, does Vladimir Putin care what happens to Navalny? After all, I mean, he is accused of ordering his poisoning in Siberia last year.
Well, exactly. If you look at what's happened to Alexei Navalny over the years and the pressure that's now coming, not just against him, which you're seeing directly, as you mentioned, his poisoning last year and now this, his imprisonment and now this hunger strike. His supporters, too, are under immense pressure, and it's increasing all the time. There are moves afoot to label anyone who is linked to the two organizations that Mr. Navalny has set up, so his anti-corruption foundation, but also his political offices right across the country. All people linked to that could imminently be labeled as extremists by Russia, under Russian law, which basically equates them to Al-Qaeda or ISIS, and will obviously have very serious implications for them. So an awful lot of pressure, and I think particularly because Alexei Navalny's supporters have called people onto the streets this week on Wednesday night. They want a massive protest in support of Mr. Navalny. And that is no coincidence that that's happening on the day that Mr. Putin himself will address the nation in his annual State of the Nation address.
Sarah, thank you very much for joining us from Moscow this morning. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Ready to roll now with the big reveal on day two of the championship draw. Here's Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Mary. Well, Leinster football and hurling is our focus this morning for our championship draws. Hurling coming up after the news at 8:30, but right now, football takes centre stage. A reminder, we're not only on the radio, you can also watch coverage of this draw on the RTE News channel. Not too many surprises in Leinster in recent years. In fact, let's be honest, it's been pretty much one-way traffic for the last decade or so. I'm joined here in studio for the draw by Pat Tian. Pat is the chair of Leinster GAA. This morning we have the draw for the first round and the quarterfinals of the competition. The semi-final draw will take place once these games are completed in the summer. So we've 11 counties in the bowls in front of Pat, and they'll earn their fate this morning with the help of three bowls. In bowl one, we have seven teams: Carlow, Louth, Longford, Offaly, Wexford, Westmeath and Wicklow. Six of these will play in the first round. One will get a bye to the quarterfinal. In bowl two, we have four semi-finalists from last year: Dublin, Kildare, Leash and Meath. These teams will go straight through to the quarterfinals this time around. But let's start with the first round games. And Pat, could you proceed with the draw? Maybe give them one final swirl for me there, please. This is our first round. These are knockout. There's no second chance. Once you're beaten, you are out of Championship 2021. Who have we got, Pat?
Offaly
in first round. Offaly, very close to your own heart there, Pat.
Keep an eye on that.
Keep an eye on them. Great tradition and doing great work at the minute under John Mohan. Offaly, who will they play in round one?
Onlu.
Louth. Mickey Hart will be taking on Offaly and John Mohan in round one. I know there'll be a lot of interest in that tie. It's going to be hard one to call, actually, between those two. Second round game, or first round game, second game.
Kilvontong.
Wicklow. Wicklow are out next. One of the very few teams yet to win a provincial title. Doing great work behind the scenes there. I know they're really developing their underage.
Loughgorman.
And they will play Wexford. That's a bit of a local derby there, the two W's. Wicklow and Wexford. We have one more first round game now. This is game C.
Carlock.
Carlow are in there. Two teams left. One will get a bye, but who will be playing in the first round?
And Longford.
And they will be playing Longford. Okay, so we'll move on to the next stage of our draw. We'll have those first round games. Will you place that last county remaining into that bowl? and into Bowl 3, and they'll contain the other first-round winners. What happens next is the semi-finalists from last year in Bowl 2 will be drawn with those in Bowl 3 to determine the four quarterfinals. Sounds a little bit complicated, I promise you. It's not. We will be very simple as we go along. Pat, maybe can you draw first from Bowl 2? This will be the teams that got to the semi-finals last year, and they get biased to the quarterfinals. Kildare are out first, so that's our first quarterfinal, and they will play.
Round 1A.
So round 1A, that's the winner of Offaly and Louth. Kildare will play the winner of Offaly and Louth. Kildare last winners in 2000. Next out.
Ahaclea.
Dublin, they will play in quarterfinal B. 10 in a row in terms of Leinster Championships. And they will play...
Round 1B.
So round 1B, that is the winner of Wicklow and Wexford. Dublin, the kingpins at the minute. They'll be away for that one, will they, Pat?
They'll be in a new... It won't be in Croke Park.
It won't be in Croke, okay. Next out, we have Laois. This is quarterfinal C. You're not giving too much away on us, Pat, this morning. I'm going to push you harder shortly.
Irvine.
Westmeath. Laois and Westmeath. That's actually another local derby and a really tight one. We've got one more quarterfinal left. Just two teams left in the bowl.
On V.
We have Meath. They are the finalists from last year. Second most successful team in Leinster. And they will play, just
round
to confirm,
one,
the winner of Carlow and Longford. I'm going to recap on that draw for our listeners and our viewers at home. In the first round, round one, we have Offaly and Louth. The winner there will play Kildare in the quarterfinal. We have Wicklow and Wexford. The winner there will play the Dubs, not in Croke Park, according to Pat. In the third quarterfinal, we have the third first round game. We have Carlow and Longford. The winner will play Meath, and we have Laois against Westmeath as well in the quarterfinals. The Dubs, they'll be on the road maybe for their first encounter. What about a potential Leinster semi-final? Will you take them out of Croke Park as well?
We'll see when the draws are made, Darren.
Pat, you're giving me absolutely nothing here this morning. No scoop, no?
No.
Let's talk to Kevin McStay. He joins us on the line. Kevin, what are your general thoughts about that Leinster draw? Anything stand out for you?
Well, the awfully loud game, I'm not sure it's so much in terms of football, but certainly in the personalities of the managers, John Mahan teeing up with Mickey Hart, that'll be interesting, and as I think you said it, hard to call that one from this distance. Other than that, Darren, it's very hard to get overly excited at the moment about the Leinster Championship draw, unfortunately. It's Dublin and the rest, isn't it?
Well, it is. It would appear to be that way. Dublin, have they any Achilles heel at all that maybe some teams can take hope from, Kevin?
Oh, gee, it's impossible to see beyond them in Leinster again this year. Just looking at their numbers last year, they played 3 matches in Leinster, Darren. Average score for 2 goals and 21. That's 27 points. Average score against 9 points. Average winning margin, 2 goals and 12. That's 18 points. They're just monstrous numbers, huge numbers. And it's a seeded draw, as you know. The 4 semi-finalists go into the opening bowl, the first bowl. So once that happens, the expectation is those 4 will repeat. And that's the way I see it at the moment as well, that they'll very much be the 4 that will come through again, most likely into the semi-finals when we have the next part of the draw. So yeah, it's very hard to see it. You can only shout, say, to the teams against them. You're looking for a bit of improvement. Can they improve on the numbers I've just mentioned there? Could they win the first half of a match? Could they win the second half of a match? That's sort of an objective. Impossible to see anybody beating Dublin at this stage.
Okay, the draw for those semi-finals will be met later. Just finally and briefly, if you don't mind, Kevin, in terms of a second best team there in Leinster at the minute?
I think Kildare and Meath would be the two I'd be looking at. Even the Westmeath gave a very decent performance, gave the best performance of anybody in Leinster last year. But I think Kildare under Jack O'Connor and Meath, who have been improving, even though they got an awful walloping in the final. They'd be the two I'd be looking at.
Kevin, great talking to you as always. Looking forward to getting back into the thick of the live action with you in a couple of weeks' time as well. That is your draw. Remind you, the Leinster Hurling draw is coming up after the news at 8:30, and then Marty Morrissey will have the Ulster Football Championship draw on the 6-1 news. Back shortly.
Now in the United States, jury deliberations will continue today in the trial of a former police officer charged with the murder of George Floyd. Derek Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges. Prosecutors say he killed Mr. Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes, but the defence has argued that the death may have been caused by drug use or an underlying condition. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan has been telling me about the final arguments from lawyers and instructions to the jury from the presiding judge.
Well, Judge Peter Cahill began his instructions to the jury by telling them that they must base their deliberations on the information they heard in the trial, not anything they heard outside of the courtroom setting. He explained the three different charges in the case: second degree unintentional murder, third degree murder, and manslaughter. Now, Derek Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to all three charges. And in closing arguments yesterday, the defense lawyer Eric Nelson repeated his claims that George Floyd's death may have been caused by something else, other factors like drug use, underlying heart problems, or maybe carbon monoxide poisoning from the vehicle close to where he was being restrained. The prosecution, of course, claims that Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes. And prosecutors told jurors yesterday to use their common sense. Believe your eyes, they told them. Trust what you felt the first time you saw that video footage of George Floyd being arrested, being pinned to the ground with a knee on his neck. That same video footage that sparked a global protest movement. The defense said, however, that the jury should not be misled by a single still frame image and that they had to look at the totality of the evidence. Derek Chauvin's lawyer, Eric Nelson, said his client had not used excessive force.
Officers are human beings, capable of making mistakes in highly stressful situations. In this case, the totality of the circumstances that were known to a reasonable police officer in the precise moment the force was used demonstrates that this was an authorized use of force. The state has failed to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore, Mr. Chauvin should be found not guilty of all counts.
And after that defence closing speech, the prosecution had the final word. They were able to deliver a rebuttal, Brian. What did the prosecutor say?
Yeah, and you mentioned, Mary, the final words. And of course, the final words in these trials can be so, so very important. The last words that the jurors hear before they retire. That fell to prosecutor Jerry Blackwell. He delivered those final words in his rebuttal to that defence argument. He said the case was so simple that a child could understand it. In fact, he said a child did understand it, referring to a 9-year-old bystander who told Officer Derek Chauvin to get off George Floyd while he was pinning him to the ground. The prosecutor dismissed the defence's arguments that the death may have been linked to drug use by George Floyd or his enlarged heart. Jerry Blackwell said it defied common sense that George Floyd just happened to die from these things while he was being restrained on the ground.
Those other factors are not direct causes of the death. The direct cause was cardiopulmonary arrest that was in the environment of the police, so dual restraint and neck compression. Point blank. You were told that Mr. Floyd died because his heart was too big. The reason George Floyd is dead is because Mr. Chauvin's heart was too small.
Tensions are running high in the United States, Brian. If this jury acquits Derek Chauvin, or if the jury convicts him on a lesser charge, are there fears of further unrest?
Absolutely, Mary. And last night, what we saw was as the jury began their deliberations, protesters started to gather outside the courthouse. Now, those deliberations last night lasted for about 4 hours. They'll resume later on today. And yes, there is wide expectation that the protests will also resume. There's a sense that if Derek Chauvin is acquitted, there could be widespread unrest. But even if he's convicted, there's also likely to be some demonstrations on the streets, perhaps even just to mark the verdict and to call for justice for other victims of police violence. Security, it's being stepped up across a number of US cities, particularly, of course, in Minneapolis, where this trial is taking place. Businesses there have been boarded up. An emergency order has been declared that will allow police officers from neighbouring states to be called in if needed, and they would join more than 3,000 National Guard troops and around 1,000 police officers who are already on duty. There are reports that the US President Joe Biden has had discussions with his advisors about possible public demonstrations that might follow the verdict. Reports too that he himself may deliver some kind of an address to the nation or public remarks following the verdict. Now, last night, the trial judge in this case, Peter Cahill, criticised a Democratic congresswoman by the name of Maxine Waters. She had said that if there's not a guilty verdict here, people should fight for justice and get more confrontational. Judge Cahill said he wouldn't declare a mistrial because of those comments, but he said they could well be used as grounds for an appeal in the future.
I wish elected officials would stop talking about this case, especially in a manner that is disrespectful to the rule of law and to the judicial branch in our function. I think if they want to give their opinions, they should do so in a respectful and in a manner that is consistent with their oath to the Constitution, to respect a co-equal branch of government. Their failure to do so, I think, is abhorrent, but I don't think it has prejudiced us with additional material that would prejudice this jury. They have been told not to watch the news. I trust they are following those instructions. A congresswoman's opinion really doesn't matter a whole lot.
Trial Judge Peter Cahill, and Brian O'Donovan will be reporting from Minneapolis as that jury verdict comes through.
The future of banking in Ireland has come under the spotlight as Ulster Bank plans to exit the market and KBC Ireland is considering the same. All the while, digital banks are growing in popularity. N26 has seen the number of its business customers treble in the past 2 years. Adrienne Gormley is the Chief Operating Officer with N26. Adrienne, are digital banks like N26 truly a threat to the traditional banks? You can get a loan from a traditional bank, but N26 doesn't offer access to loans or overdrafts here. Are there plans to offer credit facilities?
Good morning, Petula. And if I can give your listeners some context on N26, yes, we are one of the largest fully licensed digital banks across Europe with over 7 million users, which means we offer the trust and security and protected deposits like traditional banks, but also the technical and technology innovation that allows customers to open bank accounts probably before the 8 o'clock news if they wanted to this morning. We offer a wide range of free basic banking services as well as subscriptions. And from a credit perspective, we already do offer credit, loans and overdrafts in select markets, and we're always looking at ways to introduce new features and disrupt these to customers across more markets in the future.
And are you looking at introducing credit facilities here in Ireland?
Well, as I say, this is always an area of interest to us. We're still relatively new in the Irish market, and we're focused on delivering currently the best possible customer experience in basic banking in the Irish market. That said, we're fully licensed, and we're always looking at ways of disrupting. So loans is definitely an area of interest for us.
How many business customers does N26 have in Ireland? And do you know, are they also customers of traditional banks?
So our current range, we have grown significantly. So we've trebled our number of customers in the business sector. And today we are absolutely delighted to announce that we have partnered up with SumUp, which is dedicated to our business customers to allow them to accept contactless and cashless payments. As you, I'm sure, know, over the past year, the trends and the customer need and demand for contactless payments has really increased. And so as a digital business, we've been able to respond and work with our business customers and understand what their needs are. And we're delighted to be able to offer this with SumUp today.
And how many business customers do you expect will avail of it? How many business customers do you have in Ireland?
Well, I would hope that all of our business customers, so while we don't go into the specifics of numbers across different cohorts, the increase of, you know, customers, as I say, has trebled and is continuing to grow significantly. We would expect most of our customers to avail of the partnership as they continue to address their customer needs. It's very much in customers' interest to be able to offer these different cashless and contactless payment methods.
The traditional banks have made another bid to get permission for an instant payment app to compete with N26 and indeed your rivals Revolut. Is that a worry for N26 if the banks are successful?
I think we would say we're very happy to see an increased focus on customer experience from the traditional banks. It absolutely shows that we are playing an important role in bringing customer innovation into banking and that we're leading the way in what customers expect and would wish to have from their banking. We have built our business based on customer needs, and technical agility has been baked into our DNA from day one, which makes us simply more agile to be able to adapt at a very, very fast pace to new advancements in the way that maybe traditional banks find more difficult. So we will continue to offer compelling banking proposition to our customers, which are almost 200,000 in Ireland at this point in time and across many different generations, not just the young folk, but actually our second biggest growing area are the over 60s and over 65. So we can see that we are very much a banking for the time we live in rather than a bank for a particular generation.
Okay. Adrian Gormley, Chief Operating Officer with N26, thank you very much for your time this morning. Elsewhere, the euro led a rally on the back of a brightening outlook for the vaccination programme across the continent.
Experts urge caution on delaying second vaccine shot. So says the lead headline in the Irish Times. The paper reports senior medics and experts as saying that a significant benefit to the vaccination programme would be needed to justify extending the gap between doses of COVID-19 vaccines. The Irish Independent leads with the news that three cases of the new Indian strain of coronavirus were detected in Ireland yesterday. The variant has seen India added to the UK's red list of countries for mandatory hotel quarantine. It is still unclear if a similar decision will be made here, the paper says. In the Irish Examiner's main front page story, it is reported that the European Commission has ruled that Ireland cannot be trusted to police its fishing quotas under the Common Fisheries Policy. Michael Clifford writes that the Commission has withdrawn a special derogation to the state to weigh fish at factories because the authorities cannot guarantee that fraud will be detected. The Commission has now ruled that fish must be weighed at the landing point. The Times reports UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's declaration to be broadcast tonight on BBC Northern Ireland that there will be no referendum on the reunification of Ireland for a very, very long time to come. Meanwhile, loyalist protests in the north, which had paused following the death of Prince Philip, resumed last night, and they are the top story for the Irish news. The Irish Sun, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Daily Star lead with the appearance in court yesterday of Gavin Murphy, charged with the murder of his partner Jenny Poole at her home in Finglas, Dublin on Saturday. The Sun front page also carries a photograph of beer glasses laid out on the pavement outside Leinster House to form the figure 400. They were put there by the Licensed Vintners Association to mark 400 days of pub closures. Beer in Sun by May 24, says the headline, hopefully, though this is a demand from the vintners, not a promise. But the paper does report the Minister for Higher Education, Simon Harris, as hinting that more restrictions could be lifted next month. And the same hint from the same minister gives the Irish Daily Mail its lead story. He hinted that outdoor dining could resume as early as next month, the paper says. The Examiner reports that the first of 266 new homes that have been approved for the landmark St. Kevin's Hospital site on the north side of Cork City should be available within 2 years. The Land Development Agency said the primary focus of the scheme would be on the delivery of social and affordable housing. Another landmark site in Dublin is given prominence in the Independent and Times. The Independent reports that a residents' association is wary about the US property giant Heinz's plan to build 732 residential units at the former Player Wills factory on the South Circular Road in Dublin, which has been approved by Onboard Planola. Both papers quote the Residents Association spokesman Joe Clark as saying, frankly, there would be more conditions attached if you were extending your garden shed. The Player Wills scheme would include a 19-storey block, and 240 co-living rooms, which Mr. Clark, quoted in the Times, said are clearly against national policy but are still being waved through.
Three cases of a coronavirus variant first identified in India have been detected in Ireland. Two of the cases of this B1617 variant are linked to travel, according to Dr. Killian de Gascoigne of the National Virus Reference Laboratory. In the UK, India has been added to the red list of countries and the Prime Minister has cancelled a scheduled trip there next week. India is battling a devastating rise in COVID-19 infections, with a new week-long lockdown imposed on New Delhi to ease pressure on the health system there. So what do we know so far about this variant and its behaviour? Let's talk now to Dr. Gerald Barry, Assistant Professor of Virology at UCD. Dr. Barry, you're welcome to Morning Ireland.
Hi, good morning.
Now, this variant reported to have been gaining ground now in India since the start of the year, 1617. What evidence or what data has been gathered so far about it? What can you tell us?
Yeah, hi, good morning. So it was first discovered in India probably late 2020 and first seen in the UK in February of this year. It's an interesting variant because it has a kind of a collection of mutations that are causing changes in the spike protein, this famous spike that's on the outside of the virus. And it's a collection of changes that haven't been seen before. And while there's relatively little data on this exact variant, the mutations that have been seen independently in other variants all suggest either that the virus will have higher transmissibility or potentially higher ability to reduce the effectiveness of the current vaccines that we're using. So that's why there's a kind of a concern around this particular variant, because it seems to have mutations that in other variants give it an advantage.
So far, I think it's been labelled a virus of interest. It hasn't had the status yet of a variant of interest as opposed to a variant of concern. But is it likely that given its advanced scientific ability in the UK, that they will be able to make these breakthroughs on knowledge as quickly as possible?
Yeah, I think so. Like a lot of things, we're relying on the UK for data, really, and evidence on this. I suppose because a lot of the world is kind of following the UK. They're so, I suppose they have such in-depth sequencing, for example, compared to the rest of the world. And they've already identified four different changes, as I say, in the spike protein. And while they're calling it a variant of interest, the suggestion is that it will become a variant of concern. And that's really happens once evidence starts to build around two key things, which is transmissibility and kind of effectiveness of vaccine against it. So there's studies ongoing at the moment to look at the ability of antibodies to neutralize the virus in the lab, and data will come out, I'm sure, in the next few weeks on that. Mm-hmm. And then they're also studying very carefully how the virus is moving through the population, both in the UK, but also studying it very carefully in India. India is quite a challenging country. The level of sequencing is nowhere as high as we might be doing here in Ireland or the UK are doing. And also the number of cases that are being reported in India, again, wouldn't be as accurate as it would be like here in Ireland or the UK. But they're seeing a massive surge in India. I mean, they reported around 260,000 cases yesterday, just in one 24-hour period. So it's a huge surge, and that's probably an underestimation, actually, of how many cases they're seeing on a daily basis. So that kind of environment is going to drive variant development. So looking at the kind of collection of mutations in this virus, the fact that some of them are giving it the virus greater stability, greater rates of replication, in theory, it's likely that this variant will, it's predicted, I suppose, that this will become a variant of concern alongside the Brazilian and the South African that we're already familiar with.
I know some scientific experts are already labelling this year the year of the variant. Is that a description that you'd agree with?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, it's inevitable that this virus is going to change, new variants are going to pop up. We need to I suppose, take a breath with all these kind of variants and not freak out every time we hear about a new one, because we're going to be hearing about a lot of them. What's happening across the world is this process called convergent evolution. So the virus is basically learning how to live with us and how to infect us. And it's, in effect, perfecting that process, and it's getting better every time it goes into another person, and that process is going to continue. And it's because it isn't, I hate to say it, it isn't in its perfect state yet. It hasn't reached its greatest ability to infect people yet. It's likely that other changes are going to continue to happen, and so new variants are going to pop up. And the real concern, I suppose, is that while the evidence we have at the moment suggests that the vaccines we're using are effective at stopping severe disease and hospitalization against these variants, the concern would be that a variant might pop up that's resistant or might escape the vaccines we're currently using.
Yeah, very worrying description, that it's not at its zenith yet. I mean, when might that happen, or how do we prevent it? Can we prevent it happening?
Well, the best way to stop it turning into something even more infective or even more virulent is to keep case numbers as low as possible. This virus will only change if it has the ability to infect more people. And so individually, countries need to try and reduce case numbers as much as possible and stop the virus replicating, because that's how it changes. As it enters a new person, it learns a little bit more, it replicates a little bit more, and it potentially changes again. So the more times it goes into more people, the more likely it is to change. And we need to, as a collective across the world, roll out vaccines as much as possible, because that will help to stop transmission.
Okay.
And also just using all the same tactics that we've been using for the last year to try and keep case numbers down, hopefully across the world if possible.
All right. Dr. Gerald Barry of UCD, thank you very much for joining us.
Insurance companies deducting COVID subsidies from payouts to business who have made a claim for business interruption due to the pandemic. Well, the Business Post had reported that FBD was seeking to wipe thousands of euro off payouts to publicans whose policies did cover them for losses suffered during the pandemic. This followed a landmark test case in the Commercial Court earlier this year. Peter O'Dwyer's story this week said that they had seen further evidence of other insurers doing this. We'll speak to the Minister with responsibility for insurance, Sean Fleming, in just a moment. But first, the Director of the Alliance for Insurance Reform, Peter Boland, told this programme that he too was aware of it happening.
The live claims are still, in many cases, at a very early stage because the process has been very slow. But what we're hearing from one or two cases which have been finalised at this stage is that insurers are taking almost all of the state support by way of either subsidies or grants and netting them off any business interruption payments. One example that we've encountered already is a small business that would have been entitled to about 120,000 in business interruption compensation. But when state support was netted off it, the figure that was offered was 20,000. We would call on the state, either through the Department of Finance or through the Central Bank, to intervene very specifically in this area and make sure that the state does not end up subsidising insurer company profits during the pandemic.
That's Peter Boland there from the Alliance for Insurance Reform. Well, in a statement to us, FBD said they are awaiting the outcome of another court hearing to determine the amounts due, and that is expected in the coming days. They said they are providing interim payments to policyholders, which already had amounted to over 10 million euro. We can talk now to Sean Fleming, who is the Minister of State with responsibility for financial services, credit unions and insurance. Good morning.
Good morning, Audrey.
Are you aware of insurance companies deducting the value of the COVID subsidies from their payouts to businesses whose policies do qualify them to make a claim?
Yes, this matter has recently come to light, and it's an issue that I am aware of, and I specifically raised this with the Central Bank at a meeting yesterday. Now, what I have to say is that I agree with Peter Boland when he says the function of the state making payments to companies that were in trouble due to COVID-19 and had to close, that the job of the government is not to subsidise the profits of the insurance companies as part of the COVID situation. So he's quite right when he says that. But it's important just to explain what happens when a company makes an insurance claim or an individual. If you take the current situation before COVID, if somebody was involved in an accident and it was agreed that the total settlement that they should get for loss of income and injuries was, for example, 100,000, which during the course of a couple of years, the state had paid out maybe 20,000 by way of disability to the individual, the insurance company would pay the balance of the 100,000, which would be 80,000. The person would have received their total 100,000, but the insurance company would have to hand that 20,000 that the state paid out back to the state. Now, the COVID claims are new, but that is the principle I would like to see carrying through. And what that would mean in these cases, where a company has got payment from the state, the insurance company cannot be let off the hook and reduce their total payments in respect of that claim. The person who's made a claim and is... the judge says it's worth 100,000. They must get that 100,000 if their business insurance cover policy includes that. And if payments have been made by the state, I will be ensuring that these companies refund that money to the state because we paid part of the losses to that business. Okay. And I would be saying at that stage that we would want to reinvest that money that comes back from the insurance company back into the sectors that were affected by the COVID. I wouldn't like the state just to pocket that money either. I think if we do get that money, it should be given back to the sectors that were affected by this.
Okay, so you say if we do get that money back, so well, can you enforce it, or can you simply ask the insurance companies to refund it?
What we can say is the current arrangements that are currently in place ever before COVID came along, before a case is settled, for example, a car accident, an injury case, that person must produce a certificate of the payments they received from the Department of Social Protection. So there are already arrangements in place whereby payments to the state to a person making a claim for insurance get a letter from the relevant government department confirming what has been paid. So this should happen here in these cases as well, whereby if there has been payment to a company under the wage subsidy scheme or rates rebate, that information has to be documented from the state authorities. That has to be given to the insurance companies. And the most important thing here, this matter is currently before the courts, and I would hope, by not influencing the court here, that they take these factors into account to ensure that the insurance companies in total pay the full amount of the claim, albeit some of it might have to be refunded to the state, and the state then should do that money for those industries that have been affected by these insurance policies.
But if the court doesn't do that, what I'm trying to establish is there anything you can do as a government to force the insurance companies to refund that money that you're talking about? Or do you only have the power to ask them to do it?
No, well, what I will say is we haven't been in a COVID situation before, so I can't judge the outcome of the court case before the outcome of the court case happens. And as soon as that happens, we will study that very carefully. But I would expect the insurance companies to apply the same principle here that they already do in the cases that I've highlighted in the past.
Okay.
It is different, but I would expect the same principle to apply.
Okay. Will you give the central bank, who is the regulator, what about giving them the power to bring a test case to the courts to establish certainty on the insurance cover that is provided to businesses in these types of situations, rather than leaving it to the businesses to do it themselves?
Yeah, well, in the UK, they have actual authority. The equivalent body in the UK has the legal authority to do that. That legislation was never passed in Ireland. It's not on the Irish statute books. However, what the central bank has done, even though it hasn't the power to take the case itself, it did ensure that all reasonable costs got to do with the person taking the claim would be covered by the insurance companies. However, the point you make is something that can be looked at. But as we speak, that legislation doesn't exist in Ireland. And what I will say is the cases through the court that were taken in Ireland by the individual businesses themselves, with eventually the comfort from the central bank that their costs will be covered by the insurance company, have moved as quickly in Ireland as the cases have in England. So there's been no delay in this matter.
Okay, but as minister with responsibility for insurance, will you be pushing to bring that legislation?
That is something I will examine as a result of what's coming here now. The actual outcome was very clear. The timetable was the same. There was no delay. And what I would like to see, that before any cases start in future like this, the central bank would say at the commencement of the cases that the costs will be covered by the insurance company rather than it happening after a period of months. Because some of the businesses had to wait a few months until they got that clarification. That clarification is there now. It would be better if we get this earlier in cases into the future, and I think the precedent is now set. But if legislation is required, we will look at that.
Okay, and just finally, just to give businesses peace of mind, those businesses who do receive their payouts from their insurers, the state subsidies, are they guaranteed? There's no threat to them?
No, and the issue is the state has already paid these subsidies by way of rates waivers, wage subsidy payments, or some other revenue payment scheme, CRSS, or those issues. The issue in relation to the PUP payment will have to be looked at separately, because that didn't go through the business, and I don't think that should come into these cases at all. That went to the individual person who was no longer on the books of the employer, and I think that's a separate issue and shouldn't be confused by the insurance companies in dealing with these cases. But the payments that went through the businesses, like the wage subsidy scheme and race waivers, are issues that where the state has paid it in good faith, we will expect the insurance companies to cover the full cost of that, where there was a business insurance policy in place covering these issues. And we have a mechanism in place already to deal with that and to get that funds back from the insurance companies. And as soon as the court case is over, we will seek to do the exact same in these situations.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Sean Fleming, Minister of State with responsibility for insurance.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And back now to Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Mary. Well, welcome to the second of our Leinster Championship draws this morning. We have already had our football draw and the focus now is on hurling. The football, as we know, has been a little bit predictable in years, but that is not the case when it comes to hurling. So looking forward to a very interesting draw. I'm joined in studio by Pat Tehan, Leinster GAA chairman. And by way of explanation, we have two bowls. In bowl one, we have our quarterfinal teams, Antrim, Dublin, Laois and Wexford. And in bowl two, our Leinster finalists from last year, Kilkenny and Galway, who are assured of a place in the semi-finals this time around. Other than that, it's an open draw. So without further ado, let's get these quarterfinal pairings underway. Pat, give them a final swirl for me, please, and take out our first quarterfinalists. This is quarterfinal A. And we have...
Arclea.
Dublin are out first. Maddie Kenny in charge. Really pushed Kilkenny all the way in the Leinster Championship last year. Maybe unlucky to get
Antrim
beaten. And they'll play the Joe McDonagh champions there, which is Antrim. A big year for Antrim, back up at senior level. Let's see how they get on. Quarterfinal B.
Lochgorman.
Wexford are out next. They'll be bitterly disappointed with last year and how it went. Wexford in quarterfinal B, and they will play...
Laois.
Laois. We'll be talking to the former Laois manager very shortly, Eddie Brennan. So they are our quarterfinal pairings. And Pat, in terms of home and away, are these games going to be in Croke Park or neutral venues, or how is that going to work?
They'll be in neutral venues.
So those games will be in neutral venues. And the semi-finals, which are coming up?
They'll be in neutral venues.
They'll also be neutral venues. Confirm those games against Dublin, against Antrim, Wexford against Laois. Those are the quarterfinals. Let's move on to our second ball now and the semi-final, where Kilkenny and Galway joint proceedings here. This is an open draw, isn't it, Pat? Anyone
draw.
Can play anyone. So let us get on with it. Who is our first team out, please?
Kilkenny.
Kilkenny are in semi-final A. The defending Leinster champions, they will play...
Quarterfinal B.
The winner of Wexford and Laois. So, semi-final B. We know the lineup here. Let's confirm it.
Quarterfinal A.
That is the winner of Dublin and Antrim. And they will play...
Galway.
Beaten finalists last year, Galway. I'm going to recap on all of that. Pat, thanks for doing the draw with us this morning, both football and hurling, just to confirm those fixtures. In the quarterfinal, Dublin will meet Antrim. The winner will then play Galway in the semi-finals. And in quarterfinal B, it'll be Wexford and Laois. And the winner of that game will play Kilkenny in the second of the semi-finals. Let's get some reaction from Eddie Brennan, Kilkenny legend, former Laois manager. Well, Eddie, What's the feeling there?
Yeah, an interesting one, in fairness, Darren. I suppose, look, by virtue of the setup, it means Kilkenny and Galway are obviously on opposite sides, but I think they're two good preliminary games. Look, there's obviously going to be, I think, favourites in both. You know, obviously the guys that have been there and Laois and Antrim obviously have big tasks, but tasks that they will embrace anyway. And look, it throws up then, I suppose, the mouthwatering one of Davy Fitz v Brian Cody potentially again, or Cheddar Plunkett obviously. So it's quite interesting. You know, you'd say Matty Kenny then possibly going up against his old his former county, or his county of origin.
Yes, I know we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but you know, you would expect Wexford and Kilkenny to meet, wouldn't you?
You would expect that, yeah. Look, perhaps we don't know. Look, again, with venues, what way that's going to work out. But at the same time, I think it's the kind of match and the challenge that the Laois boys will embrace and they will look forward to. And it's certainly one, you know, if you're Davy Fitz, you're saying, look, this is going to be a good edge, a good match to start you off. You know, he will fully expect to get over that. They will, you know, want to obviously get a crack at Kilkenny.
And they have a point to prove, don't they, Eddie?
They do. I think Wexford had a very, very disappointing year last year. You know, I suppose, look, like anything, I think the way it played out for Davy, unfortunately, with the way the club was, he wasn't able to get the guys together, is what he said afterwards. But, you know, even still, I think he will want to definitely rectify that. And I think by virtue of the fact that he is dead on for one more year, I think he's really, really targeting a big year this year. And you'd imagine he should get some kind of a rise out of him.
I mentioned earlier about, you know, more competitive than the football, Leinster Football Championship. Really hard to pick a winner here, isn't it? If I was to push on it, who would you go for?
It's very hard to know who it is, but look, I think Kilkenny came with a very strong finish in the Leinster final last year and took it off Galway. I would imagine Galway will be, you know, really, really hungry and chomping at the bit. So if you put the gun to my head, I know who I want to win the Leinster Championship without my own county, but I have a funny feeling it could be Galway this year.
Okay, time will tell, Eddie. Great talking to you as always. Thanks for joining us here on Morning Ireland this morning. Looking forward to those matches already. Going to be just a couple of weeks, months away, and looking forward to getting back to the live action. Just in other sport briefly, let's talk about the European Super League, dominating the sports headlines right around the world. Liverpool in action last night. They are one of the Super 12, let's call them, and their manager Jurgen Klopp spoke after the 1-1 draw last night with Leeds, spoke before and after the match, incidentally, and was passionate on both occasions. And he really is not a big fan of this breakaway Super League.
It's a tough one. People are not happy with that. I can understand that. But I cannot a lot more say about it, to be honest, because we were not involved in any processes, not the players, not me. We didn't know about it. I have obviously no issues with the Champions League. I like the competitive factor of football as well. So I like the fact that West Ham might play Champions League next year. No problem. I don't want them to be honest, because we want to do that. But I like that they have the chance and all these kind of things. So the most important parts of football are the supporters and the team.
Yes, Jurgen Klopp there. It is a big week ahead for the sport of soccer. Finally, just a plug for some coverage on the RT player all this week. Beginning today, the Irish National Swimming Finals are taking place at the Aquatic Centre, and a big opportunity for a number of our prominent swimmers to get the times to qualify for the Olympic Games. That's all your sport for now.
We are going to continue the discussion on the Super League proposal. It is a big bucks US style, no relegation franchise sport. And to put it mildly, the suggestion has not gone down very well at all. We are joined by Robbie Irvin, who is chairperson of the official Liverpool Supporters Club in Kildare, and Eddie Gibbons, who is branch secretary of the Kevin Moran Manchester United Dublin Supporters Club. You're both very welcome. I know you're both not happy with the suggestion, so that's taken as read. Robbie, could I suggest to you, though, that there is a pent-up demand to see big clubs with the top players playing each other in a European competition?
Good morning, Audrey. I hear your opinion there. I think the fact of it will probably devalue the Champions League. To win this new Super League, you'd have to play 23 games. of lesser quality teams, because you don't have Bayern Munich, PSG, Ajax, Borussia Dortmund, and some of the most traditional Champions League clubs that have been out there, where a lesser number of the lesser quality of team, lesser standard of football, I think would just devalue the Premier League and the domestic trophies within the English football.
Eddie, the demand perhaps may not be in Europe to see such a league, but it's a global TV market, and there is a demand, is there not, in the Far East and in the United States?
Yes, there is, yeah. They seem to want to see all that, but they forget the history that's behind all the competitions in England and that.
What do you mean?
Well, there's a huge history going back, you know, with the Football League and the FA Cup and, you know, all these competitions. You know, the foreign crowd have just come into it in the last, say, 10, 15 years, and they seem to be, you know, going for them. They're not interested in the homegrown supporters.
But, I mean, the Premier League was a breakaway league, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was, yeah. And I think it was good for football.
Right. And, but you don't think this will be?
No, I don't. I don't think anyone I've spoken to is not happy with it at all.
Mm. Robbie, if it goes ahead and if Liverpool take part, I mean, will you keep supporting Liverpool?
Yes, I'll keep supporting Liverpool. You have to remember, owners come and go, but the club will always stay with you. The club is all about the fans. And I think all Liverpool supporters, although there's understandable frustration, anger, shock, stun, it's a very emotive subject, but I think everyone will stick by the manager and the players. It's the ownership of the club to have enforced this. If you listen to Jurgen Klopp and James Milner last night, both of them don't agree with it, and personally don't want it to happen. But we have to get behind the manager and the players. That's what we do as supporters, through the thick and thin of it.
Yeah, and Robbie, do you agree that the supporters are not powerless in this? I mean, people might suggest, well, stop supporting them. And by supporting them, they mean stop paying the TV subscription, stop going to the matches in England or elsewhere. Put your money into League of Ireland instead.
Well, I'm an avid St. Pat's fan, myself and the boys.
Yeah.
Magnificent start to the season. But why can you not do both, would be my argument. I'm a big League of Ireland supporter. I watch all the games. And same for Liverpool. Why can't you do both?
Eddie, what's your view on this? Would you keep supporting Man U?
Without a doubt, yeah. I mean, I started supporting United in 1956. So, I mean, it's part of my DNA. I couldn't give her up. But at the same time, I wouldn't watch any of these Super League matches.
You wouldn't watch them? Yeah.
No, I wouldn't watch them.
Yeah. But I heard a comparison last night, Eddie, with baseball in the United States. 100 years ago, every town had a baseball team that played in a minor league that everyone went to watch. But they're all gone now because of TV and radio rights and because of no relegation and no promotion. People lost interest. Those clubs died away. There are 30 major league teams now for the whole of the United States. And this person was making the point that there is a real danger of clubs like that. Small League of Ireland clubs here in Ireland and small clubs right across Europe going the same way if this plan gets the go-ahead. Would that be your fear?
No, I think football is vibrant and it's exciting, and the relegation and promotion thing is part of it, and it keeps us all interested. I mean, when the season is over, I mean, we all watch the relegation and the stuff, and even if your own team is not involved in it.
Mm. But I suppose, Robbie, if this new Super League takes place every week, presence guaranteed, year in, year out, no relegation, no promotion, it removes that opportunity to move to a higher level, and perhaps that could be the future for all sport. Would you worry about smaller clubs?
I would. As I said earlier on, to win this competition, you have to play 10 more games on top of your 38 league games. So you have to play 23 games, a minimum of 23 games, where they talk about soccer at the moment is reducing the number of games, where you're adding in 10 more games, and the Super League will have less European super clubs in it, and it's going to be made up with some of the biggest clubs like Bayern Munich, PSG, AX not in it. So I don't see how the standard is going to be any better. They probably will sell more subscriptions on TV, but the standard of football certainly won't be better.
Okay, well, look, great to talk to you both this morning. Thank you very much indeed, Robbie Irvine and Eddie Gibbons, Liverpool and Man U respectively. Now, the courts here have issued a European arrest warrant for Gerry Hutch in relation to the ongoing Garda investigation into the attack at the Regency Hotel in Dublin in 2016, during which David Byrne was killed. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds, joins us now. Paul, just remind us of the background to this.
Yeah, Audrey, this goes back to the shooting dead at the Regency Hotel of David Byrne in February of 2016. That was the third murder in the ongoing Hutch Kinahan feud, but it effectively escalated that feud into a murderous feud, and so far 18 people have been shot dead. Now, that murder has its roots in the murder of Gary Hutch in Spain in September of 2015, who was the first victim of this feud between two significant organised crime groups. Gary Hutch was the nephew of Gerry Hutch. He's the man known as the Monk. Gary Hutch worked with the Kinahan organised crime group. He was an active member of that group involved in drug trafficking and gun crime, but he fell out with the Kinahan organised crime group and he was targeted by that group while he was in Spain. Now, his uncle, Gerard Hutch, the leader of the Hutch organised crime group, heard about this. The Hutch gang tried to save Gary's life. It thought it had negotiated a deal a number of years ago to save Gary's life. Money was paid over to the Kinahan organised crime group, but Gary Hutch was still shot dead in Spain in September of 2015. Now, one man has been convicted of that murder there and is serving a sentence in prison. But the Gardaí believe that Gary's murder began the feud and subsequently led to the attack at the Regency. They believe that the Regency attack was retaliation by the Hutch organised crime group for the murder of Gary Hutch in Spain and the breaking of what was perceived to be an agreement between two criminal gangs. The target of the Regency was Daniel Kinahan, and as we know from the courts here, Daniel Kinahan has been named as a senior figure in organised crime and a senior figure in the Kinahan organised crime group. He was in the Regency for a boxing weigh-in that day, but he wasn't shot dead by the armed gang that went into the hotel. Another gang member, David Byrne, was shot dead. As a result of that, there was intensive retaliation by the Kinahan organised crime group, which led to the deaths of so many people on the streets of Dublin. There was also an intensive investigation by the Gardaí at Ballymun. One man, Gerard Hutch's nephew, Patrick Hutch, was charged in connection with the Regency attack, but he was acquitted at the Special Criminal Court. But that investigation continued, and that's led to this most recent development.
Yeah, and you've confirmed that this morning. A European arrest warrant issued for Gerry Hutch. What more can you tell us?
Yeah, it's first reported by Paul Williams in the Irish Independent this morning. We have confirmed it from a variety of different Garda sources. There are three reasons why a European arrest warrant is issued. For somebody to stand trial, for somebody to face sentencing after conviction, or for somebody to serve a sentence that's already been handed down, whereby one person is extradited from one European country to another. In this case, the warrant has been issued for Gerard Hutch to stand trial. He's wanted to face a trial in connection with the attack at the Regency Hotel, during which, as I said, David Byrne was shot dead. Now, the European arrest warrant can only be issued by a competent judicial authority, in other words, a judge, and the offence a person can only be extradited for must carry a term of imprisonment for longer than a year. Now, in this case, the investigating Gardaí went to the High Court, they applied and they secured a European arrest warrant for the arrest of Gerard Hutch. That has now been circulated to Interpol and to European countries. Gerard Hutch has been moving around Europe for the past 6 years. The last time he was seen in Dublin was for the funeral in 2016 of his brother Eddie Hutch, who was also a victim of the ongoing feud and was targeted by the Kinahan organised crime group. And indeed, the man that Gerard Hutch was pictured with that day also subsequently became a victim simply because he was photographed in the company of Gerard Hutch. He's believed to be moving between Spain, Central Europe. He's been spotted or identified by border authorities travelling to Germany. The Gardaí have been monitoring his movements over the last number of years, but these have certainly been restricted recently due to the COVID pandemic. There is a confidence that he will be arrested. It will be up to him then whether he decides to contest his extradition in whatever country he is detained in, or waives his right to challenge the extradition and agrees to come back here to face trial.
Paul, thank you very much. Paul Reynolds.
The Isle of Man-based airline ETL has bought Stobart Air, the operator of the Aer Lingus regional network. For more, Owen Curry, editor of Air and Travel magazine. Owen, what's the significance and the likely impact of this sale?
It means that the airline is saved. There's a nice, bright and breezy three-paragraph statement just over an hour ago saying that this recognises the brand. As it's an Irish airline based near the Crown Plaza in Sword. Stobart goes all the way back to when it started services from to the Aran Islands. But it has gone through a lot of conflict over ownership. Chief executives have come and gone. And now a gentleman called Jason Scales, who is a serial tech entrepreneur, he had his first business at 12 years of age, full, very colourful character. He set up ETL, a startup, a virtual airline in the Isle of Man. A virtual airline means you don't have aircraft. Now it does. And it means that Stobart will continue in some form.
And, you know, they had over 900 flights weekly, I think, across 30 routes, and key among them, those regional routes from the likes of Kerry and Donegal airports. Is it likely they'll continue?
They have to continue. The contract is still going until the end of next year. But the reality is that that contract was gone. Nearly everything that Stobart had worked to achieve, or Air Aran in its time had worked to achieve, had been crumbling away. Flybe was an important client. They went down just before COVID last year. COVID, the cash burn is about 23, 24 million. They got it down from a much higher cash burn early in the crisis. I suspect they were just dead airline walking, looking for someone to take them on board. The way the Aer Lingus contract, it looks like it's being set up an airline called Emerald, which was set up by Conor McCarthy, a veteran of Irish aviation, somebody who's been involved in setting up successful airlines in Asia and other countries and in maintenance. That contract is likely to go to him. So Stobart will probably reduce their fleet. They have about 13 aircraft down to 4 or 5. One of the places that has been touted as a base for operation is Belfast City, but it will be a very different operation after the Aer Lingus contract passes on, very likely, to Conor McCarthy.
Owen Curry, many thanks indeed.